Thank you. And I'm going to stop this. Good. So now let's continue our overview discussion of what database systems do for us. I listed here about six different functionalities that a database systems, that a database management system provides. And I'd like to take a somewhat closer look at what alternative techniques would, how alternative techniques could address the same functionality, so we can appreciate the what database systems give us. The first thing that they do, they allow us to create and store large data sets. We saw data sets of hundreds of thousands or millions of records, but they can be much, much larger. They can go to millions of records. They allow us to search, query, and update the data. They allow us to change the structure, and I will explain the difference between updating the data or changing the structure in a minute. Then concurrent access to many users, recovery from crashes, and security. I'm going to discuss these in more detail, so let me move on to the next following slides. And I'd like to examine for each of those six functionalities how we could achieve the same functions using alternative techniques. For example, raw files, like Unix files, or a spreadsheet. And then I'm going to contrast this with a database management system. So here is the first question to ask. For the first feature that all the database systems have, the ability to create large, to create and to store large data sets, can we achieve the same thing by simply using files? Can you store very large files? Yeah, but isn't there a but? You must know this better than I. Can you, isn't there a limit on the size of the file? Who can tell me the complete story? I know the story that at least in until very recent versions of Unix, there was a limit of the file size of 2 gigabytes, because this is how much you can address with 32 bits. So you need an operating system that understands file sizes over 2 gigabytes. Yes.
And NTFS has always supported, you know, exabytes of file size since, you know, it first came out.
So the comment is that NT supported always supported arbitrary large file size.
It supports.
And continues to support. What do people know about the latest versions of Unix or Linux? Do they have restrictions on the file size? Okay, so we don't know how to answer it. But what my point here is, in database systems, we don't have to worry about this. Now, of course, since you're great hackers, if you have to store a gazillion-sized data table on an operating system that has a restriction on the file size, what do you do?
Split it
into directories. And actually, when I was working at AT&T Labs, because some of my colleagues were part of the original designers of Linux, of Unix, they didn't believe in database systems, and they had to process massive amounts of detail called call details. Every single phone call that for every single phone call that AT&T had, there was a record. So they had to get gigabytes and gigabytes of data every day. They didn't trust the database system, but they were storing this in Unix files, and they had this very elegant directory structure, directory hierarchy, where they were storing the files. But they were great hackers. In general, we want this functionality out of the box, and that's what the database system gives us. Yes?
Also, the file, if it's a file, then you have to go through the file system, which is kind of an overhead for you. The file system is going to do who knows what with the file. It might be fragmented. All kinds of stuff may happen to it. The database system will probably do raw I/O to the the disk itself, so it can actually structure the data however it wants.
Okay, so for the Microsoft people, so the comment was that the file system might do things to the file that you don't control. It might split it or store it in ways that you don't anticipate, while the database system has raw access to the disk. And this is true. Almost all database systems, they bypass the operating system's file system and they access the disk directly, so they have full control over the I/O. And this is good. Coming back to just size, logical size, what about a spreadsheet? I can take the actors table and store it in a spreadsheet. What happens if you take 800,000 actors and store them in Excel? I tried it.
Says you can't have more than 6535 rows.
Yeah. Exactly. That's what
it is. Excel that's going to be coming out this month, right? That actually they finally got rid of that limit, but
okay.
What's the limit now?
I don't know what it is. I haven't hit it.
1 million.
1 million.
So my point is, although there might be better answers in the future, right now the only definitive yes answer is for database management systems. Let's move on to the next one: searching, querying, and updating. A particular query, an example of a query was what I showed you in SQL Server: find all movies by Hanks. Can you do this in files? If you had a huge file, can you find all entries with Hanks?
Yeah, sure. Just take a while.
Yes, sure. And the command that you would use is, that I would use, is grep. Grep is actually extremely efficient. It will read the file very, very fast. The problem with grep is it can only select from a single file. If you need to combine this data with a second file, which is a cast file, and then with a third file, which is the movie file, then you have to write an entire application to do just this. So files support very efficiently simple queries like grep. On the other hand, an update is difficult. If you want to modify, for example, what kind of update can I give you? Okay, you want to modify a movie title because it was inserted in an abbreviated form, and now you have decided to type in the full name of the file, of the movie. What happens with the file? Yes?
If this is a binary file, not enough space reserved for the file title, then you could just replace it in place. But if it's a text file, then that's just around, then it's not going
to... Right.
Exactly. So the answer was, if it's a binary file and if you have enough space to update the title, then you can just update it in place. But if you don't have enough space, or if this is a text file, then you have to start shift and moving things around. And this is what a database system does, but it does this for us, does it under the scene. And similarly, spreadsheets, they are pretty good at for simple queries and simple updates. Okay. Now, we have seen updates. Updates mean just inserting a new data value or modifying a data value or deleting a data value. Changing the structure, though, is something different. Changing the structure means changing the schema of the database, like, for example, adding a new field. Think of all the actors that we saw, and they had three or four fields: first name, last name, and gender. Now suddenly we have access, we start getting access to their address, okay, which would be very interesting to store. What does this involve? What does it involve to change the structure of the table to have a home address for every actor? It depends on how the file is laid out. But what I imagine, I have this table in my mind, I imagine going through every single record and kind of widening it, making it wider, so I can have room now for the address, which initially might be null, but later might be updated. My point is, this is a very expensive operation. And on over files, this is very hard to support. You would have to write a specialized application, essentially to copy the entire file. Spreadsheets, they are very good with this. You can easily insert a new column. But they have the other limitations. They don't allow too many rows. And in database systems, this is a non-issue. It's very easy to alter the schema. Yes.
How do they do it?
How do database systems do it? Exactly how you would hack it, but they do it for you. So what do they do? What can they do? So it depends probably from implementation to implementation. But the kind of the tricks that they can deploy are postpone it. Since by adding a new field, you're actually not providing new data. They will keep track of records that still have the old schema and the records that have the new schema. So they keep multiple they might keep multiple versions of the schema. And every time you're updating, if now you have the address of an actor and you want to update it, this is going to support that, just that record. And now this record will now conform to the new schema. Or they have tricks on how to represent nulls. So they represent nulls such that the expanded record has exactly the same physical structure as the old record that didn't have the attribute at all. And then it's very cheap to do the alter the schema. Or they just copy it. If you want to alter this field and you want to set it with a new default value that is required storage, then they do the copying for you. It will take a while, but for us it's a very simple command. What I'd like you to take out of this slide is a distinction between an update, which affects the data, and a change of the structure, an alter of the schema, which is a much more expensive operation. It's also much less frequent. Okay. The next functionality has to deal with many users, concurrent access. Usually there is a unique database that supports the application, and then there are many users, many clients that access that database. Think, for example, of a bank. It has a single database with all the accounts. But all the branches, and actually all the ATMs, and all the customers on the website and access their account, they talk to the same database. So one of the concerns of the database management system is to handle concurrent accesses. Why is it a concern? What can go wrong? Well, everything that you know from operating system that can go wrong when you have concurrent users can go wrong in databases too, but actually even more. What is a lost update? This is something that you probably know from an operating systems. What's a lost update? Yes?
The two things, read the value and add one to it and write it back and only then add it once instead of twice.
This is a great example. So there are two users. Each of them wants to add one. Each of them deposits $1 in the same account. So if they read that value sequentially, they add one in their client's memory, and then they update the value, but only one update will survive and the other one will be lost. Now operating systems already handle this. How do they handle? What is the main technique, technique for handling concurrent access to the same data? Locking. And databases use locks too. However, it's not sufficient. This is something which we will discuss and insist during the lecture when we discuss transactions and concurrent access. And the difference is because in a database application, a typical transaction, now I can call it a transaction, is a sequence of operations that affect many data items. The typical example is when you transfer money from one account into the other account. Then you are affecting two different accounts. Sometimes you affect many records from many different tables, and if transactions interfere, if these operations interfere from concurrent users, then one particular transaction may see a combination of data values that doesn't correspond to the real thing, and this is something that we need to prevent. So I can't go into details now, but be prepared in a few lectures to discuss concurrency control. The next worry of a database management system is recovery from crashes. And again, I'm giving here an example from banking, where this is where crashes are very easy to illustrate. It's very easy to illustrate why crashes are bad in this application. So here is a simple application that talks to a database. It just wants to move $100 from one account to the other account, and it does this by first reading the amount in the first account. This is X. It subtracts X, writes it back, and then reads it from the other, reads the amount in the destination account, adds 100 and writes it back. But the problem is, systems usually crash. If you're browsing with a web browser and you have a power outage, there is nothing lost. You just restart your system and you relaunch your browser. But if the database server crashes right here, then we have a problem. What is the big problem? Right, so assuming that the disk remains consistent, which we will always assume in the database context, then we end up with $100 less in the two accounts combined. This is very bad. We cannot let this happen. So what the database system needs to do is it needs to do recovery from crashes. It needs to somehow magically either revert to the state that existed before this transaction began, or somehow complete the transaction, depending on what happened with its log. And the main technique to do this is a database log. But if you look at recovery, it's kind of magic, because no matter where the system crashes, the recovery manager will ensure that it can either take the system back to a consistent state that was before the transaction started, or it can complete the transaction. Any questions so far? I realize this is a rather quick overview, and especially for transactions, we don't have time to go into details now. Okay, and finally, security. Here I wish I had a stronger story to tell you, but the security in database systems is unfortunately not powerful enough for what applications need. And one of my messages in the lecture on security is that the security system and database system is often not used, and this is actually creates a problem. But what is a security system that exists today? For file systems, we have access control. For every user, in Unix, we have only three classes of users: the owner, the group, and the world. And for each class of users, we give the permissions for the three actions: read, write, and execute. In database systems, this idea is pushed further. For every object, and the object can be a database, can be a table, or can be just a column of a table, we can give permissions to every single user in the database system. So it's a slightly extended security model. And for spreadsheets, do the spreadsheets have any security model? Do they offer any security, any access control? I'm not aware of. My knowledge, you either have access to the entire file, or you don't have access to it. That's it. You can't give access to particular fields in the spreadsheet. Okay, so The purpose of these slides so far was to give you first an overview of what database systems do, and second, to compare, to have a brief discussion of what it would involve to offer the same functionality with using some other technique like file systems or spreadsheets. So how does a database system look like? Databases, as we know them, are called client-server systems. And this was a term invented in the early 80s. And what this means is that for an application, there are two systems involved. One is a database server. And this, remember, is just a big C program written by someone else that manages all the files, and we never see the files. We only see a logical data model, which is the relational data model. And then there is the application. There is a C program or a C# program that encodes the application logic, that knows what to do with the money in the accounts and with users. And there can be multiple applications. There can be multiple clients, like these here. And they all connect to this database. So since these clients, since they don't have access directly to the file, it means that they need to talk to a database using some particular language. That language is SQL. That's a language that allows us to talk to the database without actually accessing the files. Now, one important idea in database systems that it's very simple, so this is why I won't come back to this, but I really want you to take this idea out of this course. It's the idea of data independence. And this says the following. Under the hood, the database server has no choice but to store the data as files. There is a movies file, and maybe there is a movies file that is the index for the title field of the movies, and then there is a director's file, and so on. There are files. But none of the clients has access to these files. We never see these files. We don't care about them. What we see instead is this beautiful logical view, which is called the relational model, that consists of tables. We see a director's table, a movies table, and a movie director's table, or the cast table. This separation between the logical view and the physical representation of the data is called data independence. And it means the following. It means that if your application goes slow, then the database administrator can go here to the bottom and instruct the database server to add a new index. It will create maybe a new index on whatever, on year. Right, that is, we create a movie index on year, which is a new file. At the logical level, we won't see this this new file. We see the same logical view. But what will change?
Speed.
Just the speed. And this is actually, I'm experiencing, from my point of view, I'm experiencing this every quarter when I teach this database class with this IMDb movie database. Because guess what? I give it to the TA to install it on the server, and they do a wonderful job, but I usually forget to ask them to create indexes. And then I get these angry emails from the students that say, my query takes half an hour. Oh, because we forgot to create an index. We create the index, it takes a few seconds, and now all these queries, they run much faster, and the students usually don't notice this. And this, it's really a very direct experience of this general principle, which is data independence. Data independence goes beyond that. It means that often the database system can shred apart these files and do something very, very strange to them just to improve performance. It can, for example, partition them. It can partition them vertically or horizontally. It can spread them across multiple servers. It can replicate them. It can do all sorts of stuff. But at a logical level, we don't care. What we observe is extra performance. Okay, so I'm going to skip this slide. Essentially summarizes how database systems address the six functionalities. They use SQL, and for concurrency control and recovery, they use transactions, and we are going to discuss this separately. And for security, let's skip this until we get to that lecture. Good, so this was my short overview of what a database system is. This is what we are going to discuss in this class in details. Here is a tentative outline of this course. It's pretty okay up to lecture end of 7 or so. So today we will discuss SQL. And if you know SQL, I will try to highlight some subtleties which you might know or maybe you may not know. If you don't know SQL, then I advise you to read these slides over and over again and practice as many queries as you can. If once you do the homework, you will find you will feel like, and if you don't feel an SQL expert right now, you will feel like that after you finish the homework. The next lecture, which is going to be on January 16 on a Friday, is going to be about database design, ER diagrams, and normal forms, functional dependencies, Boyce code normal form, maybe the third normal form. I have to decide whether to talk about that or not. ER diagrams are easy. Normal forms are quite difficult. So if you don't know them, or even if you think you know them, please come to this lecture and pay attention to my description of Boyce code normal form. I think I think the way I present them, I hope you will find this useful. And none of the books does a very good job as describing normal forms, although the our textbook, the Ramakrishnan, describes them correctly, especially the third normal form. The Ullman book really doesn't describe the third normal form well. Also, during the next lecture, I will discuss a little bit about C-sharp. This is what you need for the project. And if you, I will spend a few slides on this. On January 23rd, we are going to finish SQL. I'm going to discuss what remains, views constraints, which you don't need immediately for the homework or the project, and the SQL security model. And for security, think of this is going to be a fun lecture. Okay, it's not going to be it's going to be the lightweight part, but it's going to be fun because I'm trying to give to expose you a little bit to various interesting security issues that are studied today in data management, and we can discuss how well suited the various approaches are. Then I'm going to dedicate one lecture to XML, XPath, XQuery. This is not covered in the textbook. Again, the slides are self-contained. But I invite you to come to the lecture to discuss this together. It's easy, but these are new languages. How many people know XQuery? Not that many. So do come to this lecture. Transactions. I may need to spend more than one lecture. I should also point out that there is a separate course on transaction processing offered by Phil Bernstein next quarter. What you will take out of this lecture are basics. And for this lecture, I'm going to use mostly the other book, the Ullman book. Transactions are difficult in general. I will highlight the basics. And the basics, I think, are better captured in the book by Ullman. Ramakrishnan does a much better job at going deep, describing the real recovery manager, which is Aries, which was invented at IBM Almaden and now is used by all the database management systems. But it's way too complicated. Unless you know the principles, it's almost impossible to understand. So I will focus on the principles. Then in the second part, we will start discussing what happens behind the scenes. Until now, until the sixth lecture, we view the database system from the user's perspective. From a sophisticated user's perspective. But from now on, we will look at what happens behind the scenes, both to appreciate what's going on, and also if you ever need to implement a database system, then, well, this is going to be useful. How many people here happen to work on actually developing a database management? I'm thinking of SQL Server. How many people are in the SQL Server group? One person. So you will definitely need this part, but it's not just you. The techniques that we will discuss here, they both help us understand better how database management systems work, and also help us cope with other data management tasks that are not necessarily addressed by database management systems. Okay, and since this is subject to change, I shouldn't go into details here. Any questions so far? about the structure of the class.
I think one of the earlier outlines may have mentioned data mining. I know the next semester, next quarter offers a course on it. Are you going to cover that briefly?
So the question is if we cover data mining. I wasn't planning to do this, but we could include it here in advanced topics. It's one of the things we could include, some basics about data mining. So I'll keep this in mind as one of the potential topics we can cover in the advanced topics. Okay, so continuing the overview of this class, here is how we will split grading. Homework and project will have 35%, and then there will be a final. The final is usually challenging, and it's already scheduled by the university. We'll have 30%. Less points, so you have less surprises. Most of your points you will get from the homework and the project. Okay, so for next time, I would ask you to read the first chapter from this book on the web called SQL for Web Nerds by Philip Greenspun. It's a fun read. It takes you 10 minutes to read this first chapter, and it's a lot of fun, and it really gives you an interesting perspective on database systems. There is no grading. Just read it, and I'll ask you a tricky question next time.
So is the first chapter we're supposed to read,
or? Only the first chapter. You're welcome to continue to read. It gets less fun. The first chapter is especially cute. Okay. The homeworks. There will be four homeworks. They are scheduled once every 2 weeks. Every second week you have to turn in a homework. The first homework is already posted. And I said it, but let me say it again. You have to turn it in next Tuesday. What you need to do for this? You need to read it from the web. It asks you to write about 10 SQL queries on the IMDb movie database. You have to log in on the SQL server and just run these queries. Some of them are simple, some of them are pretty challenging. All the tricks that you need to answer those queries are captured in the slides for today, the slides on SQL. Including aggregates over outer joins. The question is how much time will we have to cover them. If we don't have time, then read the slides and you will find all the answers you need. When Nguyen will grade the homework, she will subtract points if your query is more complex than it needs to be. So one of the messages I'm going to try to convey to you during the second half of this lecture is to write SQL queries that are unnested, that are single-block SQL queries. Often that's not possible. You need to write nested SQL queries. But don't write unnecessarily nested SQL queries. They're inefficient, they are hard to read, hard to understand. And the other homeworks, this is what they will be about. Second is normal forms and conceptual design. The third is XML. And the fourth one is on transactions. They are not posted yet. The project. You will develop a small database application, or I should say a medium-sized database application, that is on that implements a boutique online store. Think of a mini Amazon. You're going to sell, what are you going to sell? CDs and books. And initially, you will design the schema on SQL Server, and you will build some minimal logic, and then we will give you some data to import, and then you will implement more logic, and then in the last part we will do some database tuning, but I'm still scratching my head exactly how to do this, because the resulting database is pretty small, so the fourth phase is not yet fully designed. So more details about the project. Oh, and I should say, you have to turn in a phase every second week and alternate weeks with the homework. 1 week you turn in the homework, 1 week you turn in a phase of the project. We may not grade these these projects until the very end. I only have one TA, UN, and normally I have two TAs to create the homework and the project, so I'm not sure how she will handle the additional workload. So you might have delayed feedback on the project, unfortunately. On the other hand, I don't expect anyone here to have difficulties with this project. Maybe it's going to get more challenging in the last part, but otherwise I don't foresee any difficulties.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
The homework assignments and the projects are due on alternate weeks. Do you expect that the work on the homework and the work on the projects will also take place in alternating weeks, or are they likely to overlap?
So I don't need to repeat this question, but it's a tricky one. I guess this is up to you. Since I'm a procrastinator, I will imagine that you are too, so that you usually do in the week before the due deadline, you do the work for that particular phase. But you feel free to work early, which means either to overlap or simply work early. In order to have an early start, you would have to work this coming week on both the first homework and the first phase of the project. And I don't have time today to give you any information about the project beyond what I'm telling you right now. There is, it's posted on the website, but if you get stuck, then you have to wait until next week. So does this answer, did I get your question correctly?
Yes, thank you.
Question?
Yes.
So you said the feedback of the project may be delayed. So is the format such, I mean, you just said it briefly, but would it be possible to post solutions to these phases so that we can kind of self-correct ourselves if we do see ourselves going down the wrong path? Would it be possible to post solutions kind of for the project?
So the question is if we will post solutions for the project. We can do this. The project is not tricky. It's not like you have to discover something that's hard to discover. Instead, you have to make design choices that if you make them wrong, they will hit you later. You are designing a schema to store simple things like products. If you make wrong decisions, then later when we give you the products, you won't be able to store them in your schema. Then you just need to alter it. And we will keep your first phase, and we will see that schema was not well designed. But we will allow you to correct your schema to support the data that we give you. So I don't think there is a need to post solutions. And I will try to make an effort to give you some form of feedback, though, on the project. But I don't think I can ask Nguyen to fully grade all the projects during the quarter before the final. So let's see how it works. We can fine tune this as we go. So the technology that we use for the project is, since we are connecting to SQL Server, we are going to use C# and ASP.NET. How many people know ASP.NET? Okay. Our goal is not to learn ASP.NET. We will provide you starter code that contains ASP.NET, and normally you should be able to just use it without understanding what it does. If you were ever planning to learn ASP.NET, please feel free to do this by yourself and use this as a great excuse to do it. It's a good technology to know. This course is not meant to teach you ASP.NET. C#, how many people know C#? Oh, quite a few. Of those who don't know C#, how many people do not know Java? So you don't know C#, you don't know Java.
I mean, I've worked with them, but I don't really program them.
Okay, then you know Java.
Great.
And what about you? Do you know C++?
Visual Basic.
Okay, then you might have some problems then. You need to get up to speed with these languages. C Sharp, think of it as a combination of Java and C++. If you know any of these languages, then you know C Sharp. It's essentially Java in the C++ syntax. And C++ and Java syntax are very close anyway. So learning C Sharp is a non-issue. You know it already, okay? Even if you didn't know what it means. This is what we will support. So if you have, if you get stuck, Nguyen is supposed to help you with C Sharp and ASP.NET. And we will provide starter code in these formalism. Moreover, the data we will give you in the second phase, it sits in an interesting format. It's going to be XML data stored in a relational database. That's a technology that's now supported by all three major vendors, and we will use a SQL Server extension to support XML. Now, many of you have used, lots of you actually, have used MySQL or Postgres and might feel more comfortable using this technology for the for this project. Feel free to do this if you want. But I have no clue what to tell you to expect. You are completely on your own if you use alternative technologies. For the starter code, you won't be able to use the starter code. Instead, what you can do, you can look at the functionality that you need to provide and simply implement it from scratch. It's simple. If you have experience with this, it's a no-brainer. But you have to implement it from scratch, and you will be on your own if you make this decision. Also, for the second phase, be careful, because the data that we are giving you is in on SQL Server. So somehow you have to think about how to take the data from SQL Server and move it into your MySQL or Postgres database. So it's possible to use alternative technologies. You're free to do this. We don't encourage it because we don't support it. Any other questions?
So yes. Just to be clear, I could use Python and connect to SQL Server, and that would be okay.
So the question is if you can use Python and connect to SQL Server. If you can connect to it, then yeah, you're okay.
I assume that there'll be a server that you provide that we'll be doing the project on? Or no? Yes? Maybe?
If there is a server?
Is there going to be a CS server for the project? First, to develop on our own.
So we will use the same server for both the homework and the project, and we will create the database for each of you to run your project. And by the way, I forgot a very important thing: the projects will be in teams of one or two. So let me write this here: teams of one or two people. In other words, if you want to team up, feel free to team up in groups of two, and then you can you have a partner, and then you can develop the project together. And please send email to Nguyen about this team. If you prefer to work alone, feel free to work alone. Yes.
Do you feel it's reasonable to do alone, or is it going to require two? Is the workload too much for one person? I guess is what I'm getting at, or is the workload doable by one person?
So the question is if the workload is doable by one person. If you're an experienced database implementer, it's a no-brainer. You should be able to implement this project very quickly. If you've never done this before, if most of the technology is new, then it's going to be a lot of work, I guess. Then you might prefer to team up. Okay. Unfortunately, the only way to handle this is to use the mailing list. So I will send out an announcement asking you to tell Nguyen if you decided to work in teams or if you are going to go alone, and I will give you a deadline when to submit this to Nguyen, probably before next lecture or right after next lecture, so by next Wednesday. So we need to know this. Okay, so finally a few words about accessing SQL Server. So again, the name is iProject Server, and the complete name is .cs .washington .edu. So you connect, you need to use SQL Server Management Studio. This comes with SQL Server 2005. Oops. Do you see this? I got a very nasty error message, which only shows to me, not to you. So this is SQL Server 2005. If you're using your own machine, then you need to make sure that you have the right client. This is a client software that you need to run on your machine in order to connect to SQL Server.
Is that downloadable somewhere? Because most of us, you know, at least me, I live on the east side. I assume Microsoft people don't have a problem, but coming to campus to use that is. I found something online called Management Studio Express, which seems to connect to the database and sort of work.
That's all we need.
Is it good enough?
Yeah, okay. that should be
that's
enough.
That's really downloadable, apparently.
Yeah. Does anyone else expect to have problems with downloading SQL Server 2005? The client, not the server. Okay, if you have any problems, talk to me and tune in. Okay, choose SQL Server authentication. There are two choices, Windows or SQL Server. We use a SQL Server authentication. Your login is your UW mailing address, the full address including @u.washington.edu, and your password is 12345. Change it. Don't forget to change it. And then feel free to play with IMDb. The data is a little bit old, but if you're a movie fan, who is not a movie fan? Now it's a time to really ask complicated questions and find out which actors had played in more movies than Hanks. Okay. Yeah. By the way, one of the questions in the homework is about the Bacon number. Who knows what the Bacon number is? Okay. So you would appreciate that that question. Okay. So the way I'm planning to structure the lectures is to take a 10-minute break at about this time. Is it okay with you? Is it the way you usually have the classes?
Yes.
So is it okay at Microsoft to take a 10-minute break?
Yeah.
Okay, so we resume then in 10 minutes. Okay, so is it a good time to start now? Okay, so during the second part of this lecture, we are going to discuss SQL, as I promised you. This is covered in chapters 5.1 to 5.5 in the book. And SQL, you can find resources all over the place. But also, I should point out the slides that you're seeing today, they are kind of self-contained. That's essentially all you need to know in order to solve the homework. Now, SQL, actually, is a very complex language. You probably know one or several programming languages like Java, C++, Visual Basic, and the language is not that big if you think about it. It's something you can learn in a day or two. What's open-ended is a library class. That might be books and books. But SQL is different. SQL, the language itself, takes 1,000 pages or so. And there isn't one single SQL language. There are lots of variations. One well-known is SQL 92, anti-SQL, SQL 99, which is called SQL C. And the standards committee is busy producing new and new variants of SQL. So SQL is a language nobody ever knows, except if you're on the standards committee, nobody ever knows completely. It's something you continue to learn. Which means that you will always find features that you haven't heard about, that maybe we haven't covered in class. You may ask me features that I don't know about, so don't be surprised if the professor has never heard about that particular feature of SQL. It's a very, very rich language. Interestingly, nobody But nobody supports the entire SQL language. None of the three major vendors, none of the three database management systems. And that's life. Everybody supports a different subset. Sometimes they support their own extensions. But what we will discuss in class is supported by almost every SQL implementation, and that is you need to know basically most of the time. So has two parts. Today we will study the data manipulation language, which is a part that allows us to query the data or to modify the data, to update it. There is a second part, which is called the data definition language, that is a part that allows us to create or to modify tables. That's much, much easier to understand. There are no subtleties here. I'm going to go much quicker over that part. I think three lectures from now. I need to talk about ER diagrams next time. Okay. SQL is a single data structure, and these are tables. So, it's also an archaic language. You will find that its syntax strikes you as old. For instance, it's not case sensitive, because when it was first developed in the late 70s, not all systems dealt easily with lowercase characters, so they made it case insensitive. And it has a single data structure, and that's a table. And the table, it looks like this, like what we have right now on the screen. Let me explain. There is a table name. In this case, it's called product. There are attributes. Sometimes we call them columns, column names, or attributes, or fields. And then there are rows. Each thing here is a row, or a tuple, or a record. And that's a table. Nothing else to mention at this point. So what I highlighted here in blue, that is a schema. That's called the schema of the table. It consists of the table name and the attribute names. The black part is the data, the content or the instance of the table. It's a major distinction. The schema is usually fixed. It persists for a long time. You usually keep the schema unchanged for the database for days and months and years. The data, however, changes often. We update, we insert or delete or update rows all the time. And that's a major distinction. Also, the two parts are stored in different places of the database. The schema is stored in the database catalog, and the data is stored separately. Which means that if you lose a schema, forget about the data. You lost it. Another important concept is that of a key. What is a key? We usually underline the attributes that form the key. What is a key? You must, I'm sure more than half of you know what a key is.
It has to be unique for all rows.
Exactly. It's an attribute that we declare is unique for all the rows. If we go back, the product name, pname, is unique, so therefore it's a key. And we'll come back to keys over and over again during this course. So that's the only interesting data structure that that database systems support. There are no nested tables. You know from data structures and algorithms that nested lists are what makes that particular course so fun. But there are nested tables in databases. Why not? What do we do if we would like to store a table in which one field, every value of one field is another table? It's a nested table. How can we do this in a database system that does not support nested tables?
Well, the relationship, quantity.
Exactly. Create a separate table that's flat, and then have a foreign key, which is a pointer back into the original table. So why doesn't it support it? Well, actually for two reasons. One is because we can always we can always get around it. We can always flatten a nested table and store it as a collection of flat tables. And the second is because this is a better data model, because this is a relational data model, and because it preserves the data independence principle. We think about tables as an abstract representation, and under the hood, they can be implemented in various ways, in a nested fashion or in a flat fashion, and this is not our concern. We view this as a collection of tables. Now, the types of the fields, these are called the atomic types. This is a rich, SQL supports a rich collection of atomic types. And they, these types might be vendor specific, but at least they contain things like char, varchar. What's the difference between char and varchar?
Varchar is has a variable number of characters.
Varchar is a variable number of characters, so it will keep track of how long the string actually is. But we always have to provide an upper bound, so the system knows how much to reserve. We have a large collection of integers, small integers, big integers, and I don't know them. And you would need to look them up in the documentation of the particular database system that you're using. Other data types, they have to deal with money, with time, and the standard, there is a data type called date, another one called time. SQL Server supports only daytime, so if you read from different books, be aware that in SQL Server there is only daytime. And essentially, this is not something to discuss during the lecture. You just look up the atomic data types that you need, and that's it. That's the end of the story. And remember that all the tables are flat. Okay, importantly, tables are not lists. They are not arrays. You will not find operations like first, or next, or last. So then how do we get data from tables? Well, this is where SQL comes in. We use SQL queries to get data from tables. And the basic structure of an SQL query is the select from where template. And I'm going to, instead of giving a definition, let me give you a first example. Look at this one here. This one says, and now we really have to understand every detail, it says from product, so from the table product, which is this table here, select only those records whose category is gadgets. And return everything, return all the attributes. Which means that SQL will inspect this table, will look at all those entries which are gadgets, and we return all those only those tuples. This particular operation that takes a table and selects only a subset of the rows in that table is called a selection. Here is the second query. It also does a selection because it returns only those rows whose price is greater than 100, but it also does a projection. In that it only returns some of the attributes. So it returns only the product name, the price, and the manufacturer. And we call this a selection and a projection. There is a selection here and a projection here. The projection means retaining only some of the columns, some of the fields. Interestingly, the select field does not refer to the selection. It refers to the projection. This is a legacy issue. This is how we got stuck in SQL. So these were very, very simple queries. And before I move on to more complicated things, so this is the notation I'm going to use from now on. I'm not going to illustrate the data, but I'm going to show you the input schema, what attributes are available for a query, and then the output schema. What attributes does this query return? And since there is no table name, I'm going to call this table answer. Okay, so before we plunge into more serious queries, let me give you some details. SQL is case insensitive, so you can write select uppercase or lowercase. Same for the tables and the attributes. But of course not for the for the strings, right? If you look for Hanks, Or if you look for Hanks, this is different. These are different strings.
The SQL Server, Microsoft SQL Server, isn't it by default consensus on string searches?
The question is if SQL Server is by default case insensitive on string servers. I would say no. If somebody knows better, please contradict me. But I'm pretty sure it's case sensitive on string searches.
Well, I ask because when we do it at work, it's insensitive.
Okay. I just tried it. It looks like it's insensitive. Either uppercase or lowercase, you get the same results.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Oracle.
You can set the collation in SQL Server either way.
What was the comment?
You can set the collation in SQL Server to be either way, and you can also determine what language it does the case comparison in.
Okay, so you can set it either way. One thing that really matters is that you need to put simple quotations. Don't write double quotations, but unfortunately my slides often contain double quotations. So just make sure you don't type this into SQL Server because it don't work. You'll get an error message.
Quick question.
Yes. Question.
Is the order of the statements always relevant? So like select has to come before.
The order select from where is critical. You cannot write them in another order. They have to come in this order, select from where. Interestingly, we never read it in this order. We read the from statement first. This tells us which tables are affected. And then we read the where clause, and then we read the select clause. And actually, the newer languages, like XQuery, they were designed with the right order. They start with from, and then they have the where clause, and then they have the return clause, which stands for the select clause in SQL. Okay, a fun operator in SQL, which you don't find either in programming languages, is like. Like does some pattern matching, and it's fun to play with it. When we say pname like percent gizmo percent, it means that pname can be any string that contains gizmo. Percent stands for any sequences of characters. And underscore stands for any single character. Yes, a question here.
So if we had an index on pname, this wouldn't really, it wouldn't help the square, would it? Because indices are usually sorted, and this is completely different.
So the observation was that if we have an index on pname, then that index cannot be used for this query. It's absolutely correct. This query will be much more inefficient than a query that says pname equals gizmo, because the equal query can be used can be implemented using an index.
Or gizmo percent.
Or
gizmo percent. As long as it doesn't start with a percent, I guess.
Or gizmo percent. Right. This goes. Absolutely correct. But there is also something called the full text index, which some I think SQL Server supports it, and we should be able to support this. And there is a whole line of research on how to use indexes to evaluate regular expressions, which database systems may or may not support.
Quick question.
Yes.
Is it possible to actually escape percentages and underscores if you want that in your, if you actually want this, that character in the string you want to match? So if I actually want to match 30%, is it possible to escape in that like clause?
Good. So the question is if we can escape these characters. And I really don't know. I mean, I'm sure the answer is yes, but I don't know what the escape character is. Does anyone know what the escape character is? So the answer is yes, there exists an escape character, and it's an existential proof, okay? I state that there exists an escape character, but I don't know which one it is. Just to make things concrete, in Unix, what is percent in Unix, and what is underscore in Unix? When you list file names,
star and question mark.
Star and question mark. So in case you got lost on this slide, think of percent being star and underscore being question mark in Unix. Good. So let's go to more. Still very simple SQL stuff. Normally, if you say select from, you get a bag. You get what we call a bag or a multiset. For example, if we say select category from product, we will get gadgets twice because there were two rows. There were two rows in the original table that had gadgets. If we say select distinct, like here, then duplicates will be eliminated and we get gadgets only once. A simple question, which query is more efficient, the top one or the bottom one? The bottom one, because it just traverses the table and gives you all the categories. The top one has to do an extra step to eliminate duplicates. How would you eliminate duplicates? If you have a large array of size n, what is the best asymptotic complexity for eliminating duplicates in terms of n? Yes?
Hash table.
Hash tables, what is the asymptotic complexity of hash tables for eliminating the duplicates?
Should be O of N.
Should be O of N. But the problem with hash tables is they don't guarantee this complexity. It can be as bad as N squared, right? If the data is very biased and all the items fall into the same bucket, then it degenerates to an O of N squared algorithm. What is the best guaranteed complexity that you can have? Yes?
N log N.
N log N. The best guaranteed complexity for eliminating duplicates is n log n, because you sort the array n log n steps, and then even during sorting, equal elements, they come next to each other. For our discussion, what's important is that here you need an extra step in order to eliminate duplicates. And by the way, database systems usually use hash tables because they trust. A good hash function, and this usually goes better than sorting. Yes?
Would it be different if there was an index on that field?
Right. What happens if we have an index on the category field of products? How would you evaluate this query? There are two files, right? Forget data independence. Under the hood, the database system sees two files. So there is a product file, and then there is an index file, which is a B-tree for all the categories. And what we want is select distinct category from product. How would you evaluate this query if you were SQL Server?
B-tree?
Sorry?
Traverse.
Traverse the B-tree, and what do you do with the main table?
Nothing.
Nothing. You would answer the query entirely from the index. This is called an aggressive use of index inside the database engine. And advanced database optimizers like SQL Server and DB2, they do it. I should mention the reputation in my community and the reputation that I trust is that the most advanced optimizers are DB2 and SQL Server, and it's split which one it is. Oracle has a poor optimizer, at least as a reputation. Where Oracle excels is in transaction management. Of the three systems, Postgres has perhaps the best optimizer, but in my experience, it's not as good as SQL Servers. We use both Postgres and SQL Server in our research, and complex queries are optimized well only by SQL Server. And MySQL is great for single scans. This kind of query would probably work extremely well on MySQL. As soon as you have joins or any more complicated queries, MySQL doesn't do a good job at optimizing it. Okay, next slide. Additional simple things. You can order. Normally, SQL operates on unordered structures. The tables are unordered. But once you have computed the query, you can instruct SQL to order to return the results ordered according to a certain criteria. So there is this order by statement, which has to come at the end, where we can specify an order criteria. In particular, this query does a selection on products. It selects all products whose category is Gizmo and whose price is less than 50. And then it returns the P name, the price, and the manufacturer. But it orders them by price and P name. What does it mean by ordering by price and by P name?
So if the price is same for more than one row, then
uses B-names in order to...
Exactly. If two products have the same price, then they will come next to each other, but they will be ordered by their name. So what we get here is a list of products sorted in increasing order by their price. And in case of equal prices, they are sorted alphabetically by their name. That's the meaning of these two fields here. Is this clear? I don't want to go beyond the slide. Okay. And by the way, the order is always increasing. If you want it in decreasing order, you use the desk keyword. Good. So here is a question for you, which I'm not going to address now, but please do this at home. Look at this slide and figure out what C queries return. The trick here is that, for example, here we return the categories. We don't return the product name, but we insist on ordering it on the product name. So what would the answer be? I invite you to think at home what this means, and you can always try them on SQL Server and see what they do. Good. So now let's get to more serious things, to joins. And for that, I need to discuss a concept that again, most of you know. That's of a foreign key. Look at the company table. C name is underlined. That's a company name. And what this means is that the company name is a key. And indeed, every single company here is unique. Look at the product table. Here the product name is underlined, which means that the product name is unique. But in addition to defining the keys, we also state that the manufacturer, which is not underlined, we state that this is a foreign key. What does a foreign key mean?
It means there's a key on those values are keys in another table.
So it means actually two things. First of all, it means that these are keys in the other table, and it means that they actually have to occur here.
Is that necessarily true? Like, can't you have constraint? Don't databases let you define that constraint whether or not there's is referential integrity?
So he mentioned the word constraint, which is absolutely correct. This is called a constraint, and we will study it three weeks from now in the third lecture. And this is what is enforced by the database system. It's actually quite easy to imagine what's going on. We will declare in SQL that the manufacturer field is a foreign key into company. And now what will the system do? Well, it needs to watch for insertions and deletions, right? Once we define the manufacturer to be a foreign key, what will the system enforce? For example, when you insert a new product, what will it do? Yes?
Make sure that the manufacturer is actually in the company table.
Right. So when you insert a new product, it will check that the manufacturer occurs here in the, among the companies.
So if you delete something from the company table, what is it going to do?
So what it's going to do if you try to delete something from the company table? Well, there are three policies it can apply, and we will study them. It can reject the deletion, it can go to the products and set those values to null, or it can recursively delete the products and then recursively delete.
Then it needs to know all the tables that have this as the foreign key. That's a complicated thing to do.
So he said that he needs to know the table that have this as a foreign key. And that's exactly what it needs to do, and it knows this. But I really propose that we postpone this discussion for 3 weeks from now. Right now, all I want is this product table, which has a foreign key into the company name. Very simple concept. The reason why this foreign key is important, it's like a pointer. It's because we often write queries that need to retrieve related data from two tables or from more tables. This process by which we relate data from two or more tables is called a join. It's an operation. Here is an example. So look at the schema first. We always have to understand the schema first. We have a product which has a product name, a price category, manufacturer, and we have companies with company name, stock price, and country. And we claim that the manufacturer is a foreign key into company name. We want to find all the products under $200 manufactured in Japan. Now, $200 is a field in which table?
Product.
In product. That goes into price. Japan is a field in which table? Is a country. I love this presentation manager. So here is a query. We need to go to both products and company, and we need to ensure that the country is Japan, that the price is less than 200. But then we need to ensure something else, that the manufacturer in product is the same as the company name and company. And that is this condition here. This is called the join condition. So what happens behind the scenes? I mean, what is the meaning of this? Here are the two tables, product and company. The join condition says we have to consider all pairs of tuples, but only if the company name is the same as a manufacturer. So only these pairs of tuples that are represented by these lines will be considered by the query. And in addition, we need to select those that are in Japan and those whose price is less than 200. And the answer is, so we need name and price. The answer is this. That's a join. So if you haven't seen joins before, these are the workhorse of SQL queries. Most SQL queries are like this, are join queries. They correlate data from different tables. There is a deep reason for this, and we will discuss it next time when we discuss normalization. Right now, think of them as being just nested loops, and we just need to relate the data from different tables. So here I wanted to try to run to express to write together a query that over the same schema finds all Chinese companies that manufacture products both in the electronic and in the toy category. Okay, so please examine the schema. We have a product and company, same as before. I want Chinese companies. So clearly, where do we inspect? Where do we look for China? In which field? In the country field, that's easy. But now we want the categories to be electronic and toy. So where do we look for the things electronic and toy?
Category
and product. In category and product. Good. So now let's write it. What do I write in the from clause? We need product. Let me just write P, stands for product, and
company.
And company, and we put comma between them. What do I write now in the where clause? Let's write the selection conditions first. The country is equal to China, and the category is equal to electronic, and now we're stuck. What do I? I'm tempted to write and category equals toy.
Four.
Not a good choice, right? And category equals toy. Clearly, this won't work because the category can't be electronic and toy at the same time. Let me erase it. Ouch! Can I restore it? Undo. Let me try this. Hold your breath. Good. So let me try this eraser. Yeah, it's worked. So what else? Or. So category is electronic or category equals to. Does this work? Let's make sure that this works. It doesn't work. This returns companies that either manufacture some electronic product or some toy product. But this is not what we want. We want companies that manufacture both electronics and toy products. Oops. How do we do this?
Swap them.
Sorry?
Swap the two sides. Do the or first and then do and country equals China.
Yeah. Or won't work. Because or means that it suffices to have one of them.
Can you have something like an intersection? Of
we can use unions.
You can use a union. I don't think we can use a union, because if you have a company that only manufactures electronic products, you will get it in the union.
Intersection?
Intersection is better. But let me ask you, let me try to guide your thinking. How many products do you need to see for that company? And you need two different products. One single product is not enough. Right now we have a single product. We need two products. So let me write here. It doesn't, the order doesn't matter. But my point is, product needs to occur twice in the from clause. That's the important message of this slide. Now we need to disambiguate them. So far we didn't worry about them. But now I'm going to give them variable names. I'm going to call this X. This I'm going to call Y. This I'm going to call Z. You can call them whatever you want. So now the country comes from Y. And now we can write it. Because electronics will be the category of what?
X.
Of X. X dot category is electronics. And now I'm going to go back to and. And Z dot category is T. But we are still not completely done. Now we need to do the joins. How do we do the, how do we do the join?
X dot manufacturer is
X dot manufacturer is equal to Y dot C name and
Z dot manufacturer
and Z dot manufacturer is equal to Y dot C name. Good. So this illustrates that sometimes joins are subtle. We need to iterate over the same table multiple times. This is sometimes called a self join. But I think they're pretty easy to understand once you see them. And this is a form of intersection. Joins correspond to an intersection in a deep sense, and I'll get to this sometimes in lecture 7 or so. Okay, another subtlety about joins is illustrated by this query. So this query uses the same schema and returns all countries that have at least some company that manufacture gadgets. And it's a perfectly nice query. It has a small problem. How many times will you get one particular company in the answer? As many products, as many gadget. No, let me rephrase it. This is not the right answer. It's as many companies there are times how as many products they make that are in the gadgets category. Many times, okay? And you can compute exactly how many times. How do we fix this? Add this thing here. Good. But keep in mind that by doing joins, we get duplicates.
Is distinct generally the preferred method of cutting down duplicates like that?
The question is if distinct is a preferred method for cutting duplicates. I think it's the only method for eliminating duplicates. The alternative is to use group eyes, which, given that we only have 10 minutes, I'm not sure how much I can cover today. But that's the only way we can eliminate duplicates.
I have a question. Is it possible to do distinct on a field that you don't select, and so that you get back a list of, so let's say you want some field that's related to the company, but you only want to select distinct on some other field. Like, I ran into this the other day. I was doing a query, and I wanted the distinct to be on a field that I didn't want to be selected in the resulting table.
I'm not sure this makes too much sense. I guess what you want, you want to control the number of duplicates that you get. But I'm not sure, this gets a little bit too subtle. So in general, no. In general, SQL doesn't allow you to put distinct except under the select clause. Does it make sense to put it somewhere else? I can imagine scenarios in which it might make sense, but that you would have to write those queries differently. Okay, so let me move on. I'm going to skip some slides at this point. The tuple variables, we already discussed them. Tuple variables are these X's and Y's that we add to disambiguate between tables. You can use the S keyword, or you can drop the S keyword. SQL accepts both. And finally, what does a SQL query mean? So far, we only study select from where queries. And in general, they have this structure. There are many tables in the from clause. There are lots of conditions in the where clause. And then there are some attributes, some fields that are returned by the select clause. What does it mean? The meaning, the semantics of a SQL query is captured by this nested loop. We simply iterate over the first table, and inside we iterate over the second table, and then we iterate over the last table, and finally we check out the conditions. And if the conditions are satisfied, then we compute a tuple that corresponds to the select clause, and we simply insert it, we add this to the answer that we're returning. This is the semantics. The important message is that the semantics is simple and clean, but the database system is free to evaluate the query in a totally different way. It's free to use indexes, to iterate in any order it wants, as long as it returns the same answers as the semantics dictates. Okay. So I would invite you to look at home and find the answer to this question. What does this query return? If you can't find the answer in the comments field in PowerPoint, you'll find the answer. So please look at this at home. I do want to talk a little bit about aggregate queries today in the remaining 7 minutes. So I need to skip several slides and talk about aggregate queries. So far,
I think you have a lot more than 7 minutes. Just
9:30 after 9:30.
Oh! 20, you have. Thank you. I'm confused. Yes. So if we have more than, then I should cover a little bit about us. I should cover subqueries a little bit. Thank you. So this one I'll skip anyway. So SQL queries can have nested subqueries. That's illustrated on this slide 58. This is a kind of contrived query. It's designed to be contrived. It looks for all cities, reads that black text. Find all cities that host companies, that have companies that manufacture some product bought by Joe Blow. And since we have here companies and products and purchases connects the product to a buyer. And by the way, the maker is a company. We can answer this query, and this is a concrete way to answer this. So it finds all the cities, but only for those companies that are in the result of this subquery. Now, what does this subquery do? Can you read just a subquery and figure out what it computes? It takes products and purchases, but it returns all the what?
Does the second part of the request, that the companies that manufacture products bought by Joe Blow?
It returns companies that manufacture products manufactured by Joe Blow. So therefore, the outer query just checks that company is in this set of companies. Right? So it returns what we meant to return. Yes?
Is it not possible to do this query with a single slice?
Is it possible to do it over?
Not possible to do this with a single select.
That's a good question. The question is, can we do this the same query with a single select from where statement? What do people think? Of course. Here it is. There is no way. Don't write queries like this in the homework, okay? Write them like this. We iterate over company, product, and purchase. We do the joins. We do our selection, and here it is. However, and now comes a subtle question, are these indeed equivalent? Let's look at this query first. Given one city, how many times will that city be returned? In the query that we have right now on the screen. Multiple times, but exactly how many times? I mean, how would you describe the number of times? Once for every company, and actually once for every product bought by Joe Blow for each company that makes that product, it will return. Okay, so it's kind of you multiply the companies, number of companies with the number of products bought by Joe Blow. Now let's get back to the other one. How many times will a city be returned here?
Once.
No, not exactly once.
Once per company in the first city.
As many times as many companies there are that sold to Joe Blow. Which one? Which number is bigger? This one or the one of the other slide? The other slide, because here we're kind of also multiplying with a number of products sold by that company to Joe Blow.
So N is not really a Boolean operation?
So the question is, if N is a Boolean operation, N is exactly a Boolean operation. N just checks if this particular company name belongs to a collection.
So why would company city appear more than once?
So why would company city occur more than once? Multiple. If you look at the schema, this is maybe I went a little bit too quickly. If you look at the schema, the company name is unique, but the city name doesn't have to be unique. So imagine this company table as consisting of lots of companies in Seattle, lots of companies in Portland, lots of companies in San Francisco, and so on. And the query now will return Seattle many times. Once for every Seattle company that satisfies this Boolean condition. Does this make sense? So if we had 10 companies in Seattle and 5 of them sold to Joe Blow, then this query will return 5 times Seattle. But if each of those 5 companies sold 3 products to Joe Blow, Then the following query will return how many times Seattle? 15 times. That is the difference. So the message here is that these two queries are not exactly the same just because of the number of duplicates that they return, and also that you need to be familiarized to reason about this number of duplicates. You need to understand how many times every particular value is returned. Yes?
So because this thing returns more results, does that mean this is less efficient than the other one?
So the question is, if this query is less efficient than the other one, I would argue that this query, the unnested, the flat one, the single select from where query, is much more efficient than the previous one. Even if it returns more answers. Well, this also depends on the implementation. You can imagine implementations in which the previous one is more efficient by exploiting exactly what he said, that there are fewer answers. But in general, MySQL, for example, did not support nested queries in their earlier versions. Only the latest version supports nested queries. Most implementations, including Postgres, have a hard time optimizing nested queries. Only the advanced commercial optimizers do a good job at optimizing the nested queries. And even there, it gets harder and harder the more nested they are.
So with a nested query versus this one, aren't you, so in this case the database is kind of free to do the join in any order it wants. It can look at any table it wants first, right? In the other one, you're kind of forcing it to do the nested query first, however it wants, and then do the other join. You see what I'm saying? Because in this case, it could do the first thing first, assuming that it would give you less results, so that you have less things to iterate over.
Right. So what he said is that in this query, right here, the database system can choose any join order. It can use any index and can essentially apply any order it wants. But in the previous query, the database system is more constrained. It apparently has to start evaluating the inner query first. But I've been surprised often how smart certain optimizers are. They can still use indexes even for these complicated queries. And there is an entire theory on how to flatten and represent nested queries and optimize them. And sometimes they get very efficient at optimizing these queries. However, the database system must be aware that the number of duplicates returned by this query is different from the previous one. But for our discussion, here is the simple slide that summarizes everything. If you put distinct on both queries, then they are precisely the same. And this is the way you should think about your homework. Put distinct and forget about try to avoid nested subqueries. Try to write the queries as flat as you can. Many of the queries on the homework cannot be completely flattened. They need nested subqueries. But you have to figure out which ones. Even more complicated nested subqueries. There are three constructs in SQL. One is exists. This is just a Boolean condition. We can write a subquery R, and we check if it's non-empty. Exists just means non-empty. And the other two are quite powerful. It takes a value, and in a Boolean and a relational operator, which can be greater or greater than or equal, or not equal, and it checks this against all the values returned by a subquery, or against some value returned by a subquery. Let's look at the example here. What does it do? What does this example compute? Without reading the text. So it returns all product names that have what property? Their price is greater than all the products made by Gizmoworks. Yes, strictly greater than. So let's examine this query from different angles. Will it return the products made by Gizmoworks? No, we know this, because if it's made by Gizmoworks, then it can't be greater, its price cannot be strictly greater than all the prices made by Gizmoworks. Is this query clear? Let me ask you a different question. Suppose in our table, in our product table, there are no products made by Gizmoworks. Gizmoworks doesn't appear. There is no such company. And we try to run this query. What will we get? Will we get an error? Will we get an empty answer? Or will we get something else? Empty answer here. What? Everything. All the products.
Everything.
We get everything. And this has to deal with if you remember from mathematics, the semantics of the for all operator. When we say for all x in a certain set, R, checks the property phi. If this set is empty, then this predicate is automatically satisfied. This formula is automatically satisfied. It's true. If you don't like first of the logic, then think about this way. Suppose I have two products made by Gizmoworks. What do I need to check to verify whether one particular product satisfies the condition? That is, price is greater than both of these two products. Okay. Now suppose I remove one of them. I only keep one product made by GizmoWorks. Will I get more answers or fewer answers? I will get more, because now more of, I only need to check one condition, and I will get more answers. Now if I have zero products that are made by GizmoWorks, what should I get? Even more products, actually all of them. Then I get all the answers.
You only get more if the one you remove is the highest price.
More or the same.
More of the same. That's correct.
So the semantics of the all operator defined such that if the condition it's evaluating is the empty set is zero rows, that the condition will automatically pass. That's its semantic definition.
Yes. So the question is, the semantics, is the semantics of the all operator such that if the set it applies to is empty, it will automatically be satisfied? And the answer is yes. Then the condition is automatically satisfied. A question here.
So if you do that same query, except you do it less than all, and GizmoWorks makes no products, are you again going to get all rows, or are you going to get no?
So what happens if I replace this with less than, and the set is still empty? And we still get all products. So if the set is empty, it's almost like a contradiction. If we write greater than or if we write less than, we still get all the products. If we write equals or different, we still get all the products.
So it's not treating it as zero, it's just sort of throwing away that. It's
not treating this as a zero, but zero here represents the number of conditions it needs to check. If it needs to check zero conditions, then they are automatically true.
If you write equals, why would you get all the products?
If you write equals, well, you only get all the products if this set is empty. If this set is equal to the if this has zero products, then you get all the products. Because what this equal means, it means that you need to check as many equality conditions, as many elements you have in the set.
So if you have two products, it doesn't mean that the price is equal to, that the two prices are identical.
If you have two products, then this is precisely what it means. If you write here equal, it means that this price must be equal to both those prices in the set. And as a consequence, those two prices must be equal.
Okay.
It has it's a very powerful operator, and it's actually related to the for all operator in first order logic. It has this more contrived semantics based on the relational operator. So, question to you: can we write this query as a single select from where block? This is always a question to ask when you write a SQL query. Can we write this as a single select from where clause? Yes.
Yes, you would have to use two. From the table name twice in the from clause, and then I think
you would have to use product twice in the from clauses. Definitely, we would have to use it twice. Sorry.
Yeah. So basically, he's describing self join. I think that should be possible.
So we should try hard, right, to try to solve. Actually, the answer is no. And this is perhaps my best advertising for database theory. Here is my snapshot of database theory for today, for 9 o'clock, Friday night. I can't believe it. You're learning database theory at Friday night, 9 o'clock. Think of a query in the abstract. It takes tables, its operator over tables, R, S, T, blah, blah, blah. It does self joins, and it does whatever. It returns a set of answers. I'm going to call this query monotone if it has the following property. If I throw it at larger tables, so the same or maybe with extra tuples. So I'm going to run the same query over the same tables, perhaps with additional tuples. Then it should always be the case that the new query returns all the tuples that were before, perhaps more. Then we call it monotone. So monoton means that if you apply it to larger tables, you should get at least the same answers, perhaps more. Right? Now, here is a theorem. Every select from where query is monoton. And that's because, if you remember the semantics, which was right here, that's the semantics. It does these nested loops, and if I increase any of these tables, these loops will only iterate over and have more iterations. So therefore, I will get at least the same answers as I got over the smaller tables. So does everyone agree that does everyone agree that every single block select from where query without these fancy operators like all or subqueries is monoton? Yes. It's a very intuitive statement. However, this all query that we had, this is not monoton. Now I can erase. Just because of our observations. If this subquery returns two products, then we get some answer. But if we decrease product to make it return just one, then we get more answers. Or try to think in the counterpositive. If we had a single product matching that was made by Gizmo work, then we get some answers. But if we increase, we add a second product made by Gizmo work, which might be more expensive, then we get fewer answers. So here is a clear evidence that this query is not monoton. If you add more products, if you insert some products made by Gizmo works that are expensive, you're essentially ruling out some of the answers. This query is not monoton. So therefore, here is database theory. It can't be expressed as a single select from where query. Did I say it? No. But that's a conclusion. So the conclusion is that query cannot be expressed as a single block. Yes? So
can every monotone query be expressed as a select from where query?
Can every monotone query be expressed as a select from where query? Definitely not. At least union queries, they require unions. But beyond that, it's one of the major open problems in finite model theory. Is it the case that every monotone query that you can express in mathematical logic over finite structures can be expressed in terms of only the positive operators in logic, which means existential quantifiers and, or, but no negations and no universal quantifiers? And what's strange is that people know that the answer is yes if you allow this to run range over infinite structures, but nobody knows the answer for finite structures. This is how difficult it gets when it comes to database theory. So in short, the answer is we don't know. And especially in SQL, it gets even monotone queries, they can have arithmetic and all sorts of things that require us to do subqueries.
Question.
Yes.
So can any nested query be expressed in a single block if it's not using any of these fancy keywords at all?
Can any nested query be expressed as a single block if it doesn't use fancy fancy operations? I can't make a general statement like this. For example, there might be duplicates. At least you should worry about duplicates. But if there is a select distinct, I would at least try. I would try to rewrite it. But I don't. There is no general statement of this kind that we can use. It's just an indication that we might be able to rewrite it. Yeah.
Instead of all queues any, then it would be monotone, right?
That's an excellent observation. If instead of all we have any, that's an existential quantifier. That's much easier to express. That can almost always be expressed as a single block query. And actually, I have later some slides, but we probably won't get to them today, that precisely makes this point, this distinction. Good. So I invite you to read about these complex correlated queries at home. because I do want to talk about aggregations. You need this in the homework. And if you haven't seen aggregations before, I'd like to describe them. So far, all the queries that we have seen, they might have fancy conditions, fancy selection conditions, but in the end, what they return are just data values from the database that existed already in the tables. But often, in real applications, you want to combine these values to compute some kind of aggregates. So let's look at this one here. This is the average. This simply says, compute the average price of all products made by Toyota. And by the way, I hope you notice, this is incorrect, okay? Don't try this at home, put single quotation mark. I made these slides wrongly years ago and I'm just inheriting them. So, how many answers will this query return? How many tuples?
One.
Just one, which is one number, the average price. What does this one do? Count. It returns one single value, which counts. It counts the number of tuples made after 1995. I'd like you to remember that there are five standard aggregate operators in SQL. Sum, count, which we saw, min, max, and average. Average is here. In reality, SQL has many, many more additional aggregate operators, but these were the old basic five ones. These were the only ones I know, and they are essentially sufficient for most of what we need. So more examples, simple examples. What happens if we apply count to something else in star? And the answer is nothing. We get the same thing, because duplicates are not eliminated by default. So if you're counting categories, you remember from our early examples, you get essentially duplicates, so it's the same thing as counting star.
Do null values change the result?
Oh, yes. If you had null values, which you haven't discussed yet, then the result will change. This count here will skip null values. So then they are not exactly the same. But what I wanted to show you here is that you can use distinct. Although my impression is that SQL Server doesn't implement this feature, distinct undercount. Okay, you can also apply aggregate operations to some arithmetic expressions like multiplying price and quantity and then adding them. And you can combine this with selections. These queries are pretty straightforward. What I want to show you are queries with group I. So this is not interesting. Here are the interesting queries. These are the most frequently used queries, I think, in applications. Queries that, besides joins, also do some aggregates. But they don't return a single value. They return one aggregate for every group of data values in the database. So what does it mean? Let's take this example here. It goes to purchase. It does some selection, which I'm going to ignore. It's here just to remind you that we can always add selections. And then it does this. It groups by product. Now product is this, this attribute here. It's a product name. And for each such group, it returns a product, and it returns this this aggregate. This is done in three steps. The first step is to compute the from and the where clauses, and we know what this means. It means, if I go back, it means we just essentially compute this query, like select star. And I'm going to skip this step because we already understand this. The next step is to group the results by the attributes in the group by. And finally, we apply an aggregate for each group. And I'm going to show you on the next slide what this means. Here is what it means. After the first step, we get a table like this. And what the second step does is that it groups them based on the product. Now this slide is a little bit deceiving because it suggests that there are exactly two entries in each group. That's not the case. Groups may have different number of entries. They are defined by this attribute, which means that all tuples that share the same product value, they are in the same group. And finally, for each group, we apply the aggregate operator, which means that we multiply these values and then we add them. And similarly here. And that's illustrated on the next slide. So we take this group and we produce a single answer. Take this group, produce a single answer. So a query without a group I, with an aggregate operation, returns a single answer. A query with a group I and aggregates returns many answers. And there is an aggregate value for each group returned by the query. That's the idea. So let's look at this query here. But let me ask you this. What happens if I drop the product from the select clause? What will the query return? Sorry?
A bunch of numbers that you don't know what they
want? Then it will return a bunch of numbers that you don't know what they are. Did everyone hear from Microsoft?
Yeah.
Okay, you don't know what they are, and this is correct. We probably want to include product in the select clause. But I want to ask you something else. So let's put it back. And now let's do another experiment. Let me include here date. I'm going to add some attribute in the select clause as opposed to deleting it. What will it return now?
Error.
An error. Why an error? Why doesn't it simply expand this answer to include the date?
But they multiple days. Which one?
Sorry? From Microsoft?
There are multiple dates within the group.
Because there are multiple dates. And there is no principled way to take these multiple dates and report a single date for Baker. For a very simple reason. Yes?
Can you do another aggregate? Can you say, I also want some of the dates or something?
You can do the other aggregate, which is absolutely good. So I can do this. I can take the maximum of the dates, which is the latest date when that product was sold. I can do this. But the message here is, there is a certain relationship between the attributes that are listed in the product and the group I and the attributes that are not aggregated in select. What is the relationship between this set, let me call it S2, and this set S1?
S1 is a subset of
S2. S1 must be a subset of S2 or equal. And it should be clear on this slide why. Okay. Another way to look at this. You don't need to understand group I's to answer that query. Here is another way to answer the same query. If all you want is for every product some aggregate value, then we just get it. We iterate over these purchases. We make sure that the selection condition is in place, and we return the product name. And now we need next to that product name, next to the product name, we need the aggregate value. So let's compute it. It's right here. This says go over all the purchases again. Make sure that they refer to our current product. Oops, we also need to check the date, right? Same condition again. And just compute the aggregate. This is the simple aggregate query without a group I. Just returns a single number. But it's a subquery. It's a subquery using the select clause, which means that for every product, for every X, we will call this, we will invoke this subquery to get one aggregate value. It should be clear that this query here computes the same thing as the query above. But which query do you think is more efficient? The first one. Because well, very advanced optimizers might recognize the bottom query as being the top query. But you know what? I haven't tried this, but I actually bet that very few will recognize this. And to see the problem, look at this condition, the date. If we forgot the date condition, then the bottom query would be completely different. So the optimizer needs to check a very difficult condition about this subquery to make sure that the bottom query is the same as the top query. And needs to check some query equivalence. That's something that database theoreticians love and do and understand, and database implementations have never quite implemented query equivalence and query containment. What matters for us now is that you should write the query like this, not like the query at the bottom. Always try to write a single block query, even if with group bytes. Try to avoid nested subqueries. Okay, this doesn't illustrate anything new that we haven't seen yet. The last two things that I'd like to show you in the remaining 3 minutes, and now there are just 3 minutes, are the having clause and then how to deal with empty groups. So we have seen what happens with a where condition. Every tuple that doesn't match the where condition is simply removed. We don't care about it. But in SQL, we can write a new clause, which is a having clause. What does it mean? What does a having clause do here? It's like a where, but the difference is that it can apply an aggregate operator in order to decide whether the entire group applies or not. So, unfortunately, SQL is complicated, and this illustrates part of the complication. In the where clause, we can write only the conditions that apply to a single tuple. But if we want to check an aggregate condition that applies to the entire group, then that condition has to go in the having clause. So this now summarizes group by queries. They have this structure. There is a select from where core that we have already studied. There is a group by. And then there might be a having clause. And the semantics is the following. First, we evaluate the select, actually the from where condition. Then we group by the attributes, as I showed you in the pictures. Then, step three, we may need to remove some groups based on the second condition that now computes aggregates. And finally, we compute the aggregates in the S, in the select field, and this is what we return. Okay, question for you. Let me go back to one of the slides. Suppose for one product, for Gizmo, none of the Gizmo products satisfies this date condition. So the Gizmo product has a date that doesn't satisfy this condition here. Then we will get zero here, right? Because it's a sum. Do we get zero? We do not get zero. What happens? The answer was it got filtered out before we did the grouping. That is a problem. Every group that survives that we get during the grouping is non-empty. There must be at least one tuple, otherwise it's not a group. So therefore, when you want to compute sums or totals and keep the zeros, we have a problem. The solution to this problem is to use nulls. you need to compute that you need to prepare your data in such a way that you include even the tuples that don't satisfy the condition, but with null. And you need to read the slides to find out how to do this. The keyword to look for is an outer join. Okay, so please read these slides at home, and read about left and right, and full outer joints. You only need the left outer join in order to compute group aggregates with nulls. So this again is important for aggregates with nulls. So, unfortunately, we have to stop here. I could never imagine that I would be able to cover the entire SQL in one lecture, and it didn't happen. The miracle didn't happen. I had 120 slides, and I only got to 80 or so. But the good news is, it's not that hard, okay? So I'm sure that if you read the slides carefully, if you try the examples, and if you try to think about the questions in the homework, you'll figure it out. Also, feel free to ask questions by email. I'm supposed to have email access where I travel. If I don't have it, then I will answer them after I return on Sunday night or Monday. Also, feel free to CC Nguyen, and she may be able to answer you. So your goal for next time is to become, in 10 days, SQL expert, and to turn in a homework, and then next time we move on. Yes, last question.
Can I ask a question about the nested queries? What does it mean when you can remove the nested queries? Like, you have to have a bad schema and you can do
If you cannot remove the nested query, it means that the query is more complicated, and then that you just have to live with it. You have to run the nested query.
Is it possible to simplify the query by, let's say, adding more columns to your
Almost never. So if the query cannot be unnested, if it has to stay unnested, then it's a feature of the query logic. It's not a fault in your schema design. Okay, have a nice weekend and a great week, and I'll see you on Tuesday the 16th.